ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Ian from Narrabeen's just texted in saying, I've heard there are unusual warm water corals beginning to develop off Manly near Sydney. I know, we've heard this. This is partly what sparked the conversation we're going to have tonight. Australia's coral reefs, you know, are known worldwide for their colour and diversity. And I suppose these days we often talk about their deterioration. It's one of Australia's great sad sack stories in a way, isn't it, that the devastation of the coral reefs. As the oceans warm, the fragile underwater ecosystems are bearing the brunt of the march of climate change. There's no other way to sugarcoat it. But in a turn of events, new coral growth has been noted further south than previously recorded. And the presence of tropical corals have been established on some of Sydney's rocky reefs, particularly from Cabbage Tree Bay to North Head. Some species have adapted to survive in the cooler, nutrient-rich waters, thriving in conditions that would normally stress or bleach tropical corals. So what does it mean for the oceans? Are there new fish species being found amongst these corals? Is coral health on the improve? Well, Dr. Jan Matthews is a marine biologist and chemical ecologist at UTS, and she specialises in coral reef resilience and ocean health. Jen's the founder of a global initiative, Big Blue Conservation, focused on reef restoration and sustainable marine practices. And she's just spent a week on the Great Barrier Reef on a research trip and is coming to us from Cairns tonight. Jen, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Great. What's the weather? What's the day been like? What's the weather like in Cairns tonight?
It's been a wonderful week, actually. The coral were spawning this week, which is always a fantastic event.
Yeah,
one of nature's most spectacular events. It's really quite impressive. And for the first time in a couple of years, we've actually been blessed with the weather and nice calm seas so far. I don't want to jinx it, but it's been a very successful spawn.
Very good. I'll come back to you in a minute and get you to tell me about coral spawning. It is quite a spectacular thing. I think I've seen it once in my life, but I'm sure you've seen it many times. Look, also joining us tonight, Professor Zoe Richards. Zoe is a coral taxonomist. How about that? At Curtin University and marine invertebrate curator at the Western Australian Museum. Zoe leads the Coral Conservation and Research Group and is focusing on coral biodiversity and conservation genetics. And Zoe comes to us from Perth. Zoe, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you too. So between the two of you, we've got the east and west coasts covered, so we should be right for most areas. If you've got questions for either of our experts, 1300 800 222 is the number to call, 1300 800 222, or you can text on 0467 922 702. Now, Jan, just maybe to you first, you've just spent a week out in a pontoon off Cairns looking at the Great Barrier Reef and you saw a coral spawn. Tell me about that. It's a remarkable thing, isn't it? Not easy to tell.
Not just one coral. It's an entire reef of spawning. It is, it's incredible. About a couple of days after full moon in late spring, kind of early summer, all the corals release all of their eggs and sperm into the water, and they do it quite simultaneously. So it's almost like it's snowing upside down. It's really, really quite spectacular.
Corals are animals, aren't they? And a spawn. A spawn is when simultaneously they're releasing eggs and sperm in the water.
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, so it gives a chance. Obviously, the corals can't move. They can't reproduce by moving to find a mate. So the way that they reproduce is by releasing their eggs and sperm into the water so it can mix with other colonies nearby that are the same species. And that helps to increase that genetic diversity of the offspring.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, does it happen once a year or how often does it happen?
Well, it depends on the region. So in the Great Barrier Reef, we have a couple of spawnings, one in November and one in December. But then where Zoe is on the West Coast, it's more April, May time. And so and then in Thailand, it's another time, and Fiji, it will be another time. So they're, it's a little bit more localized in terms of the time of year. But the most corals do spawn just once a year. It's quite, it requires a lot of energy for them to produce all these eggs and sperm. So they do it just once a year. It's pretty amazing.
Zoe, you would have seen this, I'm sure, in your research work, have you?
Yeah, I've seen it. It's really spectacular. Yeah, just an underwater snowstorm, you know, and sometimes all the other animals are excited, you know, like the fish are feeding and the holothurians, the sea cucumbers, they can be spawning at the same time. So it's like go time on the reef, you know, like it's really exciting. And then over here in the West, we do have all the whale sharks turn up around the time of coral spawning on Ningaloo Reef as well. So, you know, it attracts lots of prey and, yeah, it's just new life, you know. That's what it's representing, yeah. The next generation. So this is all positive. So it's so wonderful to hear Jen talking about this excellent spawning on the GBR this year, and hopefully that's happening right across the GBR, because this is what we need. We need these corals to feel healthy enough to be able to spawn the next generation, you know, because exactly. If they're feeling stressed, then they're not able to reproduce successfully, and that's when we start getting real problems in the system in terms of recovery. So, yeah, happy to hear, Jen, that it's spawning over there. That's really music to my ears.
Very good.
Yeah,
yes.
It was really spectacular.
I've only ever experienced it once, and that was at one of the southernmost coral reefs in the country at Lord Howe Island, when there was a spawn. And I remember there was a particular smell, a scent in the air as well. And is that a thing, Jen and Zoe?
Yeah, absolutely. You can almost smell when it's going to happen or when it's just started, because the reef starts to stink. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah,
I think once the spawn starts to rot, you know, the bacteria gets into it as well, and then when that spawn, some of that spawn washes up, it can be a bit of a stinky part of you, but that's what you got to take. For the good, there's always a little bit of bad, so that's okay. We'll take the stink if we get all these new corals out there.
So the idea is that they fertilise themselves, and then what? The density of the gametes presumably is heavier, so they, fall onto the reefs and grow. Is that the idea?
Kind of. So they're mainly about 70% fat. So when they first form, they float.
Okay.
And that helps because they're really small. They're like a third of a millimetre, so really, really tiny. And they float along in the currents. And over the next 2 days, they start to change into a fully formed swimming larvae, which is still very, very small, still less than a millimetre. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, they've used up a lot of the fats in their bodies and they start to sink. And that's when they need to find where it is they're going to spend the rest of their life. So they do something called settling. They find where they want to live, and they form into these tiny little juvenile corals that look like a petal or a small flower on the floor.
They take a long time to grow, don't they, or not?
Some corals can grow a lot faster than others, but the branching ones that you see, kind of the iconic corals that you kind of see all the fish living in and out, they will grow a little bit faster than those big boulder ones. I don't know if you saw a couple of years ago, there was the biggest coral was discovered, and it was something like meters wide, but 5 meters wide or something. That thing would be hundreds of years old.
Right.
Because of the rate, the slow growth that it grows, the slow rate of growth. So, but the branching ones, they tend to grow a little bit quicker, a couple of centimetres a year.
Zoe, tell me, how do the east and west reefs differ? I mean, I love the way you talk about the GBR, that's the Great Barrier Reef, and there's Ningaloo is probably the famous one that we know that everyone else in the country would have heard of from the west. How do they differ, or are they the same?
Oh, no, they're quite different, really. Like, there are a lot of shared fauna, but the Great Barrier Reef is exactly what it sounds like, a great, huge network of reefs that has a big barrier offshore, and then there's all this lagoonal back reef, patch reef habitat. So there's just a huge complex and network of reefs that are all quite interconnected, stretching all the way up the Queensland coastline into the Torres Strait. So that's a massive reef system. But in Western Australia, we have the Ningaloo Reef, which is also, as you say, very famous because it's another World Heritage Area. Mm. And that's the world's largest western-facing fringing reef. So that one is much closer to the shoreline. On the Great Barrier Reef, you actually have to travel most of the time a fair way on a boat to start getting to the reefs. But at Ningaloo, you can literally swim off the beach 10 metres and you start seeing coral. So this reef is much, much closer to the shore, and then it drops off very deep. We get big, deep canyons really quite close to the mainland off the Ningaloo area. And then we don't have this big complex of reefs like the Great Barrier Reef has, but we still have many islands spread all the way up around the northwest, and all those islands have fringing reef. And then between the islands, there's a lot of sort of inter-reefal habitat that also has a lot of corals, but a lot of sponges and soft corals and whole heap of other invertebrate animals. And then we've got our offshore atolls like Scott Reef and Rolly Shoals. These are remnants of the ancient coastline and the drowned reefs that used to be out there. Mm-hmm. And then we have all the way through the Kimberley, a big archipelago of islands that all have reefs all around them. So we have, you know, a similar sort of quantity, I guess, and variety of corals in particular, but there's sort of different environments and different layout over here.
Yeah, Doug from Newcastle, if you'd like to ask a question, by the way, 1-300-800-222 is the number. G'day, Doug.
Yeah, mate, how are you?
Good.
Good. Right, I've got a couple of questions. Mm. The first one is, are there male and female coral?
Mm-hmm.
The second question is, coral to me aren't very large, so where the hell do they keep all those eggs, and how many eggs does each coral polyp reproduce?
Mm. All right, Jen, Zoe, who wants to have a crack?
Yeah, really, really excellent questions. And hard to answer. So there are male and female corals. For example, mushroom corals, you'll get one male and one female, and they'll release their separate gametes at the same time. But then the corals that I was experimenting on up in the Great Barrier Reef this week were called Acropora. They're the branching corals, and they produce egg sperm bundles. So it's essentially like a little ball, or a hollow ball of eggs, made up of eggs. And then within the middle is a little sperm sac. And then these egg bundles float up to the surface and release the sperm as the kind of break towards, like a bubble popping on the surface and releasing the sperm. And then the eggs fall out into the ocean. So yes and no, there are males and females, and then there are hermaphroditic corals. And there's some corals that release these egg sperm bundles, and some corals even release fully formed planula or fully formed larvae. So almost like human pregnancies, we release a fully formed human, they release a fully formed larvae into the ocean. So lots of different types of reproduction. They like to, you know, throw it out the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
They'll do all these different things. And then your other question was on how they fit them in. So each coral colony that you see is made up of, it's a colonial coral animal, sorry. So it's made up of hundreds or thousands of different mouths or polyps. And then within each polyp, there will be a single egg bundle or planula for that spawning season.
Okay, we're talking corals tonight with our guests, Zoe Richards from Curtin University in WA, and Jen Matthews is up in Cairns on a research trip there, and she's on the GBR, as the insiders call it, the Great Barrier Reef. Jen and Zoe, what's the state of things every time we talk about reefs? And unfortunately, this topic tends to be always one of gloom and doom. And, you know, there is a lot of gloom, I know. What's the current state? Jen, can we talk with you first maybe about what's going on in Cairns with the GBR?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, as Zoe mentioned, the fact that they're reproducing is a really great sign because they wouldn't be putting their energy into something like reproducing if they were so stressed that they had to hold on to their energy in order to survive. But at the same time, when you dive on the reef, there is a lot of evidence of recent destruction, of recent bleaching and events, and huge table corals, which were probably magnificent when they were alive, are completely just bare skeleton covered in algae now. So there is still evidence on the reef of the mass bleaching events that have proceeded over the last couple of years. And the water this year is currently warmer than it normally is. So that doesn't, it's not a great sign because it means then this could be a third year in a row that we'll see mass bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef. And all those small, tiny baby corals that were just released will be too young to survive those kind of events unless they have a higher resilience. And so, yeah, it would be almost like a waste of time.
Tell me about the bleaching. Why does it, what's the temperature range in which corals can survive?
It really depends on the coral species, and Zoe is a really great person to probably answer this in terms of the Kimberley corals are quite spectacular in terms of their heat tolerance.
Zoe, tell me about Ningaloo. What's the situation?
Oh, right. Well, if we're just going to talk first about Ningaloo, Ningaloo has had a devastating year. Last year, your listeners might have heard that it was the fourth global bleaching event. So 84% of coral reefs around the world were impacted during this fourth global bleaching event, including Ningaloo. But not only Ningaloo, all the coral reefs on the entire northwest shelf of Western Australia and our offshore atolls were all impacted. But Ningaloo really took the brunt of it, and I've been there during the bleaching event, and I've just come back from a resurvey trying to see how much mortality occurred, and the news is not great. It looks like on the northern part of Ningaloo, particularly in the lagoon, 2 out of 3 corals died. So we've had a huge amount of mortality from this one event has just come through, done a massive selective sweep against these fast-growing Acropora species that Jen was referring to, which are often the ones that are, you know, contributing a lot of the recruits to the reef, and they colonize quickly and they grow fast, but they kind of like boom and bust situation. And we've just experienced the bust on Ningaloo Reef, unfortunately. So, yeah, the corals are not in a good state, and those that have survived, there's a lot of Drapella. So Drapella are a coral-eating snail. So, you know, in the 80s, there were millions of Drapella at Ningaloo Reef, and they had a huge impact back then, and there's just never been an outbreak like that ever since. But now the last remaining corals are starting to be impacted by Drapella, but what we're also seeing at Ningaloo, unfortunately, is quite a bit of disease popping up. So when the corals are stressed, even though they may have survived, their immune system has been lowered and they have been compromised, and that gives diseases a bit of an opportunity to jump in and take over. So even though there are some survivors, some of them are still really struggling out there with these cumulative impacts and other follow-on disturbances in addition to the bleaching. So it's all pretty devastating on the west. Unfortunately, some parts of the Pilbara as well, you know, your listeners may have heard of this term called degree heating weeks, and that just kind of talks about how long a place stays hot for, and the longer a location has that warm water, the more detrimental it is to the corals. So, for example, after 8-degree heating weeks, corals are likely to be bleaching and some beginning to die. After 16, you're probably getting really severe levels of mortality. In the Pilbara, we were getting like 36-degree heating weeks, which is completely and utterly unprecedented and really hasn't happened ever before in Australia. So we're getting these really intense event this year that's just broken all the records in terms of heating and the amount of time that heat has stayed around. So once you get this level of impact, that's just pushing a lot of the corals well beyond their ability to survive.
We're talking corals tonight with two scientists, Professor Zoe Richards and Dr. Jen Matthews. They're in on the GBR, on the Great Barrier Reef, and also in Western Australia. So we're talking about both sides of the country. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Emily is in Launceston. Hello, Emily.
Hello. I have a question. We're currently seeing the coalition fighting over net zero, and we're seeing global warming. Climate change affecting our waters. We're seeing these massive coral bleaches. It feels like a lot. It feels overwhelming. I know there are programs such as the Great Barrier Reef Survey. What are things that the everyday person can do to try and help our reefs?
This is a great question. Jen, Zoe, go on.
I'll jump in first. I think Jen will definitely have some more to say, and I'm just going to say a bit of a sort of holistic thing. Like, you know, you're living in Tasmania. You might feel like isolated from the reef, but, you know, your voice really matters. And I think a lot of what's going on here is a reflection that there's not enough public demand for change. So, you know, there's no political will to make these changes that are necessary to protect corals, to protect our environment in general. So we really just need to sort of ramp up our public demand for this change. So your voice really matters. And, you know, you can be on the phone calling politicians, but you can also be around your dinner table talking to your family, influencing the people in your circle, like educating people as much as you can, educating yourself and passing that knowledge on to try and build this momentum towards a broader push from the public towards making these changes. Because if no one's screaming at the governments to do this, clearly they're not going to do it because there's other economic drivers that are louder and more important. So, you know, I think this is where we all need to, like, get together and in more of a consolidated front try and make our voices heard. So, you know, that's just one level of things that can be done, but I wouldn't underestimate how important it is to use your voice use education and help you educate your family, educate your friends, and bring everybody along the ride with you on this.
Yep.
Jen, thanks. Do you want to add on to that?
Go on, Jen.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I think it can be overwhelming. It can be, and I totally respect that and acknowledge that. And but Australians as well, there's such a huge economic and iconic view of the reef. I think there was a report out recently from Deloitte and they estimated something like $124 billion in terms of economic opportunity over the next 50 years that we could have from the reef if we do something about climate change. It offers 77,000 full-time jobs. It's the fifth, rivals the fifth business and largest employer in Australia. So it's not just valuable in terms of its ecosystem value, and it's, you know, it's an immense iconic and economic value to Australia. So it would be in our duty to really preserve it. And as general Australians, there are still things that you can do. If you don't live on the reef, you could go and visit one. Supporting ecotourism operators, supporting research search for them entropically. For example, the Sydney Institute of Marine Science holds an annual dinner every year to help fundraise in order to support their projects. So things like that are really important to fuel research and to fuel the argument for protecting them and how we can best protect them.
Okay. Emily, that may not satisfy you, but
locally, Peter Wish Wilson in Launceston, just recently held a viewing of a local film made about reefs.
Yeah,
programs like that run locally of film screenings of documentaries and gathering around together and doing great the surveys for the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah.
Sort of things that people could implement in their local areas.
Yeah, I imagine they are. Jen and Zoe, briefly, I imagine they are.
There's, if you visit a reef, if you take a photo of it, then you can actually upload it to the Great Barrier. This is on the Great Barrier Reef. You can upload it to the Great Barrier Reef Census, and that helps us understand how the reef is changing just from citizen science. There's even in Sydney as well, we're trying to use citizen scientists to map the corals in Sydney because we just don't know where they are, and it's unfeasible and unrealistic to be able to survey the entire Sydney. So there's definitely things you can do by getting in the water, and then of course watching campaigns and supporting campaigns. And there's lots of opportunities as well if you want to bring science to classrooms. If you ever want to have a scientist talk about the reefs and their research and provide examples, I know many scientists who would jump at the chance to share their research in classrooms.
Tell me, Jen, what's going on with this situation down south and the discovery of corals near Sydney. And Zoe, I don't know whether this has happened in WA, but what's going on? Is this simply a case of the water's warmer all of a sudden down south and so we're seeing corals grow or what?
I love Sydney because shout out to your previous caller about Narrabeen. I live in Manly Vale, so I'm very close to these Sydney corals. And I love Sydney because it's what we call a biogeographic transition zone. It's essentially a fancy way of saying it's where subtropical and temperate water meets. And so it offers this really valuable opportunity for us to see how the landscape is changing moving from temperate into subtropical. And so these corals turning up. So these corals have been there for a very long time. They've been there so we have a coral that's always been there. It's called Plesiastria, and it's a small encrusting coral, and that stretches all around the south coast of Australia, actually. But what we're starting to see is these Postellopora corals, which are they look like cauliflowers, essentially. Mm. And they are a subtropical coral. And in about 50 years ago, I think, is the earliest record we have of it. And then John Sear, a photographer in Sydney, he ventured out to Manly Head in 2013 and saw a couple of these corals were larger than he'd seen them before. And then we started to monitor them. And within the last 10 years, we've gone from having a few colonies here and there to having entire fields of them. And I am not kidding when I say entire fields. Now the entire of Manly Heads is just covered in these corals, which sounds like a success story, but means to us.
Is it a good news story or is it not?
Well, you know what? I would love the Great Barrier Reef on my Manly Vale doorstep. It means less travel up to Cairns, although I love Cairns. It would be lovely to be able to go diving off my doorstep. But unfortunately, it's not a good sign because it means that the water is getting warmer and more favourable for those subtropical species. And it's bringing with it other things as well. So it's bringing, you mentioned earlier, subtropical fish. And there was a book recently produced that describes 700 species of fish, including some subtropical ones in Sydney. And as well as fish, it's bringing crabs, and all of these things are new to our ecosystems in Sydney. And so what does that mean for the existing species in Sydney? Well, we just don't know. Are they harmless refugees seeking cooler climates, or are they dangerous invaders that are starting to take over our landscape and will change it from that beautiful New South Wales marine scape that we know?
What about you, Zoe? Is this happening in WA or not?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I literally had somebody email me a picture this week from Rottnest Island, which is an island just offshore from Perth.
I know, we know, Roddy. You're saying there are corals on Roddy? What?
Oh, there's definitely corals on Roddy, but there's a new coral, a new kid on the block, and a plating Acropora has shown up. So this is one that's very common and dominant from Abrolhos Islands and north. Mm-hmm. But we've never had this at the Rottnest Island before. So this is a fascinating new record. And so this whole phenomenon that you're talking about is called tropicalization. So these tropical species extending their range south. And as Jen has alluded to, you know, it's quite good for the tropical species because, you know, they are able to respond to what's going on in the hot end up towards the equator. And they can move south, but there's a whole heap of species, especially in the southwest corner, that we call endemic. That means they only occur in the southwest of WA. So when we have all these tropical species coming in, those guys have nowhere to go. They can't just keep going south. You know, they're in the Southern Ocean with no habitat. So if they're losing habitat, there's quite a risk that some of our endemic species might end up being pushed towards extinction. So there's always, you know, two sides to the story, and this concept that what else are they bringing with them? They could be bringing, you know, diseases, tropical diseases, and where there's coral, that's the habitat. There's always going to be an associated fauna. So there will be fish coming, crabs, mollusks, and, you know, all these things can be really competitive with those regional endemics that we have in the southwest. So it's kind of like watch this space situation. It's definitely happening. Like we had manta rays in Coburn Sound this summer, which is not normal at all. And there's been all sorts of incredibly unusual records of tropical fish down towards Bremer Bay. Like, yeah, the things are on the move out there.
Okay, all right. Just a couple of things that people are raising too. In fact, Rhonda from Katoomba. Hi, Rhonda.
Yeah, hi, Phil. Hi. I guess. Look, I'm trying to remember. I don't recall the exact details, but I think it was the Morrison government that gave an extraordinary amount of money to an organisation, I think it was a small organisation, an unproven organisation to look after the Great Barrier Reef. And I'm just wondering if there's any data on that, if there's any...
That's right. I remember that. I'm sure there was some controversy about it, wasn't it, because the organisation didn't have much of a track record, and I think they got something like $400 million.
They got a lot of money, Phil. Jen, and it was very controversial, yeah.
Jen, what do you know about this? What happened to it?
I don't. Zoe, do you know about this?
Oh, look, I know of the controversy, but, you know, like a lot of these things in the media, I would hazard to guess that it sort of the way this money transfer happened may have been less than ideal from what it sounds like, but nevertheless those funds were dispersed amongst many many groups, many many scientists, and there certainly were projects undertaken with those funds, and some of them were seed projects that have grown into other things.
Okay.
And
anyway,
other times
the money did, you know, the money did go to coral researchers in the end. That's the main thing.
Oh yeah, I'd certainly have every confidence that it was put towards the reef. Whether, you know, that original arrangement was ideal or not is kind of not my place to say.
All right, let's move on. what's happened to the crown of thorn starfish, say, quite a number of my texters, because it was some, you know, a decade ago or so ago, this was, we were hearing about this dreadful pest all of the time, and they, you know, there were people saying that this is just going to eat the Great Barrier Reef, this whole thing, and these days we don't hear about it so much. Jen, is that because everyone's sick of it, or is it still a pest, or what's happened?
So crown of thorns in small numbers are actually really helpful for the reef because they will eat coral, which is what they've, you know, evolved to do, but that provides a new opportunity for a new space for a new organism. But it's the issue comes when there's too many of them because they will just consume large fields of corals very quickly. But I guess in a way the crown of thorns can be evidence of successful restoration action. And strategies. There's been
what? Hang on, I'm confused here. Is the crown of thorns not a problem anymore, or it still is?
It's not a problem. It's well managed now. It's much better managed now. So it's not a problem. And especially as environments change, then that shifts the bar, and it may mean that what is currently working is no longer working. But there's some really great mechanisms in place for predicting them now. eDNA being one of them, environmental DNA, allows us to predict where they are before we can even see them. So it allows us to pick up small juvenile populations and intervene before they become a big problem. So there are some, in a way, this is a good example of where research and kind of strategies has helped to mitigate some of the dangers. Mm. But it's not a problem that's no longer there. It's just actually the strategies that we have in place now are currently working.
Mm. It was apparently Malcolm Turnbull that gave the money, the $400 million apparently, Scott Morrison. But anyway, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Paul's on the road. G'day, Paul.
How you going, Bill?
Yeah, good, mate.
Yeah. I think I was a second too late, mate. I was just going to mention that the president of our land-based fishing club in Esperance caught a dolphin fish in Wiley Bay off the south coast.
Mate. Oh, really? Okay, that's a tropical fish, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm wondering what your guests thought about that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I guess that's evidence of what you're saying. Is it Zoe that we're seeing things further south than they used to be?
Oh yeah, the fish are on the move. So the Leeuwin Current is what's driving down the West Australian coast and bringing all that warm water. So fish like that, dolphin fish, you know, and the manta, they're just riding that current. And while they're still in the warm water, like it's good for them. So. Mm. Yeah, we've also had a whole heap of turtles, like hawksbill turtles washing up, like, because once it gets cold, then they're like, oh, hang on, this is not what I asked for. So when it comes to winter, they often, like, strand up on the beach and the parks and wildlife have men to deal with these turtles and try and, you know, relocate them back up to the warmer water. So, yeah, the question with these things is, like, sure, they can make it down south in the summer, riding the Leeuwin Current, but what about the winter? Can they survive those winter cold waters? And that's the bit that we're sort of waiting to see. But, you know, over time they'll probably acclimate and then eventually there'll be some sort of small genetic changes that will let them survive in those colder areas. Also depends on how much predation is there and, you know, something might stand out like a sore thumb and get, you know, the attention of like a white shark or whatever in the southwest. So, yeah, there's a lot of factors that can determine the survivorship of these tropical vagrants that are coming into these subtropical locations.
Okay, tell me about the techniques that are available for restoring degraded reefs. If reefs have been eaten out by starfish or degraded from bleaching, is it possible that some corals may be acclimatising to the situation and may be able to recolonise these places, and could we help it along? I know that there's a fair bit of work going on about this. Is it at any stage of success so far, and what do you think the prospects are? Jen, Zoe?
Well, I'm just going to say something first and then I'll let Jen talk about the restoration side, because we're not really getting into the restoration that much in WA yet, but it's coming. But There are some really seriously hardy corals out there, and I'm just going to give you one little example. Some listeners may have heard of a place called Coral Bay, which is part of Ningaloo Reef.
Yep.
It's a beautiful little reef system and a, you know, family holiday destination 101 for West Australians. But in 2022, there was a big mass spawning event there, and all the coral spawn got trapped in the bay. And then it started to rot, and that caused a huge deoxygenation event in the bay. And there was a massive fish kill, kind of like what's happened in South Australia, but this one was due to the spawn rotting, not an algal bloom. And then all the coral died. But so we went from like 70% coral cover down to 1% coral cover in that bay, and we had 26 different genera, different types of corals, and there were only two that survived. So these two corals are called Cyphastra and Parietes. So those are really extremely naturally resilient corals that have also largely survived this heat wave event that we've just experienced.
Okay.
So there certainly are some corals out there that have some extra superpowers that we don't quite understand yet. So those corals are doing really well, and they're actually taking over all that available space that's there, and coming back with a vengeance.
This is a hope.
There's a little bit of hope.
Jen, what about on your side? There's a thing called reef seed I've heard of. Tell me about this.
True. I mean, so Australia is really a global leader in kind of reef restoration space. It's basically running the world's biggest experiment of how to help reefs in a way. And there's a number of different things being trialed from small coral nurseries to more high-tech reef seeding and the coral larval reef seed, as you mentioned, and heat-tolerant breeding like Zoe just mentioned. But I guess that I would take all of these restoration methods. What we need to remember is that restoration is not a silver bullet. It will buy time for reefs, and it will build their resilience. But ultimately, emissions need to be reduced if we're going to give reefs a fighting chance. But the Reef Seed Program is a great example of one that is really such an impressive technique, and it's harvesting a natural process of corals and their, you know, natural diversity producing mechanisms to hopefully create more resilient corals, like Zoe just mentioned. And it's a wonderful way as well of involving local communities. So this Reef Seed Program is about almost like a larval rearing system in a box, and it is a very easy thing to set up. You can collect coral spawn, rear it in a nice protected environment, and generate millions of tiny baby corals that can then hopefully rebuild reefs and support rebuild degraded reefs. Almost like if you were to reseed a forest after a fire, a very similar thing.
Okay.
That's a really great example of restoration on the Great Barrier Reef.
Paul from Townsville says, just back on the Crown of Thorns, but what are you saying here? Has climate change reduced their numbers, or have they simply disappeared, or what?
Not at all. They are still a major and ongoing problem for the Great Barrier Reef. I don't want that to be, undersold. It's just that
there are fewer of them, are there?
It's hard to say. A lot of the juveniles you can hardly see. They're so small and they hide in the nooks and crannies. But we're getting better at monitoring them, I think.
Okay.
Can I just jump in one little second there, Jen, if you don't mind?
Yeah, of course.
Some of my colleagues at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, you know, from what I hear from them, the current outbreak of Crown of Thorns is around the Swain Reefs. So it's more the southern section of the Great Barrier Reef. They seem to almost like move in waves. So some years they're a big problem on the northern section of the Great Barrier Reef, and then they'll be, years later in the central. And so right now they're in the Swains. But, you know, when we have a whole successful cohort of juveniles, they often show up again in the north and then they'll sort of make their way south. So it's my understanding that right now where the crown of thorns are a problem is the sort of southern part okay. of the Great Barrier Reef, and it's lesser of an issue in the northern part.
Sure.
But they are actively removing, like killing crown of thorns out there on the reef, as well as learning much more about the survivorship of larvae and whether it's the amount of nutrients in our rivers that eutrophication of the water that's helping the coral, I mean the crown of thorn larvae, to have greater survivorship. So there's heaps and heaps of research that's gone into this space. Yeah, and as Jen says, that's we're having some positive effects.
We're going to have to run because when you start talking coral, you're having fun. And but unfortunately, fun runs out when the news is headed our way. I do think you both, my guests tonight have been Dr. Jen Matthews from UTS up on the GBR, the Great Barrier Reef, and Professor Zoe Richards at Curtin University off the WA coast. Thank you to both of you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good on you. And thanks for the text as well. I hope we answered some questions for you and gave you a glimmer of hope.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.